for understanding those things, either in the context of formal studies, experiments, and or observational data available on the basis of polygraphs that had been administered and ongoing programs. We're looking at this from the broadest possible perspective, and you might have gleaned that from the varied set of topics that are on the agenda today. Among the things that we were asked to consider as a committee were what alternative technologies might be for the kinds of things that polygraphs are being used for in the context of screening. And so a piece of the agenda today is looking at alternate technologies as well. These are all, virtually everything on the agenda today is part of what has been an ongoing process of exploration. For the presenters, let me encourage you to assume that we are knowledgeable, but not too knowledgeable. We may well have read things that you have written, but we have all been selected because we have not been engaged in research directly in this area. The committee is not shy, and they will stop you if you ever used a term or made a reference to something that they find confusing. On the other hand, what we really would appreciate is sort of the nub of what you think is the scientific evidence for that component of the material we've asked you to make presentations on. And things that you have to say that might relate to the spread of things I've referred to are all things that we'll explore with you informally as well as formally. The format for today is brief presentations followed by discussion. And if people's presentations actually didn't take the full time, that would not be a bad thing. I say that as somebody who's never had a presentation shorter than his allotted time. My students know that I go right to the 50 minutes in my lectures, or the hour.
You stop.
I do stop. Most of the time. So, with that as introduction, let me begin the individual introductions with my own, and then we'll go to the end of the table, swing around, and then the outside ring and swing around. I'm Stephen Feinberg. I'm a statistician at Carnegie Mellon University, and I'm chair of the committee.
My name is John Harris. I'm with the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, and I'll be talking today briefly about some of the work we've been doing there over the last many years.
I'm Annie Donchin from the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois, and I'll discuss CRPs.
My name is Alexandra Slockridge. I'm a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon University Statistics, and I'm looking at some data analysis of polygraph data and viewing algorithms for computerized scoring of polygraph data.
I'm Jim Blaskis from the Psychology Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
I'm Patricia Brown from the Biostatistics
Department
of Minnesota.
I'm Emmett Keeler. I'm a mathematician from Rand Shelton. I'm a member of the committee.
Kevin Murphy, Psychology Department at Penn State. I'm a member
of Paul Stern, I'm a psychologist by training, a study director for the committee.
I'm Chris Cartel, and I'm director of the Board on Behavioral, Cognitive, and Sensory Sciences at the National Academies. Well, that board is one of the two boards that's sponsoring this work.
John Sweat, psychologist. I've spent a career with a company called Bull Brannick and Newman BBN Technologies in Cambridge. work, but now I work for free. Nobody paid me.
I'm Kathy Lasky, and I'm in the Systems Engineering and Operations Research Department at George Mason University, and I'm a member of the committee.
I'm Rich Schifrin, a psychologist in cognitive science at Indiana University, and also a member of the committee. Peter Brady, biologist in the epidemiology at the Clinic Foundation, and more recently from the University of Illinois Department of Social Studies and Information Science.
I'm Andy White, a biostatistician and also director of the Committee on National Statistics, which is the other National Research Council board sponsoring the study.
I'm Sheila Reed. I work with the North Texas State Hospital. I'm here to talk about the test form.
Charles Hans. I'm a psychologist at Boise State University. I'm one of the speakers.
Bill Iacono from the University of Minnesota, also one of the speakers.
Why don't we just keep coming around the other way?
Oh, Rosanna Hunt, sidekick, Charles Hunt. I'm Mary Robinson, also from North Texas State Hospital.
David Russellman, Department of Energy.
Yeah.
Bill Fairweather, Central Intelligence Agency.
I'm Mike McNeil, welcome to that.
Jerry Craig, Defense Intelligence Agency.
I'm Andy Ryan with the Department of Defense Polygraph Institute.
I'm Justin Barrett from the Psychology Department at the University of Prospect.
And my name is Sean Efron. I'm a journalist with CBS.
I guess that's. Let me just explain the facilities if it hasn't been obvious. There are washrooms out in the ante room there. There is coffee there, soft drinks and the machine available, and juice available all day, and a cookie jar. We will break at approximately 12:15 and go back for lunch in the main house, and I believe staff are here, and if you have problems of any sort or logistical issues, you can ask. If you have material that needs to be copied for people here, we have copying facilities both here and up in the main academy house. And with that, I'd like to turn to our first presenter, Charles Hunt. Oh, I should point out for everybody, for those of you in the previous meetings, you'll notice that some of us have chosen more informal attire. This is Cape Cod, and although staff have chosen to be in uniform, at least two have got ties on. I encourage people to take theirs off and enjoy the weather. It probably a warm day once the fog burns up.
Good morning, and thank you all for having me here. It's an honor to root for such an impressive group. It's a little unusual. We all get sort of trapped in our own disciplines and get used to talking to psychologists or statisticians or mathematicians or whatever. So I've kind of oriented this presentation eclectically, and for some of you it's going to be some material you've seen before, and for others of you I hope it's new. A little bit about my background. I think I bring sort of a unique background into this. I had a career as a polygraph examiner before going back to graduate school. So I've actually worked with the polygraph field. I've run polygraph tests, both criminal investigative kinds of tests and screening tests. Trained as a psychophysiologist. I've published a fair amount in this area. Probably run as many laboratory studies as anybody in the world. And one thing you miss by not having worked in this area is the power of the technique and actually seeing it work. It's extremely powerful to test an individual and then have them confess a heinous crime to you, or have an adult break down and cry when they've been told they've passed one of these tests. And
the Department of Defense. I was with the Department of Defense Polygraph Institute for 2 years, 3 months, and 17 days. And remember it well. But from that, I bring a perspective of just how important these techniques are to the government and how much the government relies on them, and just what is riding on the outcome of these tests, and that, how much weight is given to them, and what a serious role they have. Dr. Hartel posed five questions to me, and my talk is oriented around those five questions. I don't know whether I'm the only person who got those five questions or not. So, the first was, how appropriate are the physiological indicators measured by the polygraph for the detection deception of personnel screening setting, especially given individual differences in the effects of factors such as sleep loss, drugs, illness, etc.? I think you really need to think about that from two perspectives. I think it's actually a very complex question. One is, what sort of a potential has been established in the scientific laboratory? And then the other one is, what's actually going on out in the real world? And I'm going to argue for you that those things don't match very well. A number of physiological measures have been looked at in the laboratory. Extensive amount of work. I would cite John Kircher and David Raskin for having really led this work. And what's been found is that there are the traditional polygraph measures actually do come up with pretty good predictive validities in the lab. I've got some predictive coefficients. Respiration measures we use correlate with truth or deception about 0.55. Raleigh blood pressure about 0.61, electrodermal response 0.77, vasomotor response about 0.6. These are not bad. For psychologists, these are fairly heavy validity coefficients. And so I think there is
certainly... Wait for just a second.
Sure.
If we could just backpedal that slide. Just realize. don't worry about that. I just realized
that
might not be.
No, it's not going to let me come back.
That's always my nightmare, too.
Yep.
Sorry. The validity coefficients you gave from lab settings, do you know how the base rate for deception in the different lab studies has influences us? And
no, I don't. Almost all of the lab studies that have been run have used equal base rates, so it hasn't been a concern. I'm going to swing back by base rates later on. It's a great question, but unless I say otherwise, let's assume equal base rates, and then I'll come back to that problem later.
The reason I raise the question is that the first question you're asked to address is specifically in the setting of screening.
Right.
And my guess is that the base rates for screening exams are different than for other applications.
Probably. I am going to come back.
Okay.
We've done research in both the laboratory and the field. We like the lab because we have control. Everybody here, I think, knows that. I'm going to belabor that. Field's important because it allows us to work under real-world settings and motivations. Again, everybody here, I think, has a good understanding of that. Laboratory studies, and these are a set of laboratory studies. If you're interested in what the sources are, those are available on my web pages. You've got the site to the web page on a handout I've left with you, so I won't run through those. But the high laboratory studies tend to produce pretty good accuracy rates. We've got a pretty low incorrect rate here, a little bit less than 10%, again about 10% inconclusive outcomes, and not doing too bad. Published studies, peer-reviewed journals, pretty good stuff. And same thing with field studies. One thing we tend to see in the field studies are lower accuracy rates with truthful people. And that's been a pretty general finding from, and these are forensic tests, not screening tests. I'm going to come back to the screening tests in a minute. Most of the data we have, in fact, almost all of it, is on the forensic test. And so I'm using this to say this is in sort of the ideal setting. Interestingly, if we look at original examiners, the data in the previous slide were from independent evaluators, and we like to have independent evaluators because they're not contaminated by contact with the subject. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Charles. How did you
select the studies for the last two graphs that showed accuracies for field and lab.
We yeah.
Study one, there were four studies where, you know, there are maybe a dozen or so existing.
Right. Those are from an amicus that was written for the U.S. Supreme Court, which is on my web pages, and the criteria are all laid out there. The lab studies used subjects recruited from the general population. They had some incentive associated with the outcome of the test, and they used realistic field techniques.
They didn't include, for example, all of the OTA studies.
No, not all of them. It's a subset.
Are they more recent than the OTA studies?
Yes. I think all of them. All but one are. All but one are. And then the field studies are random select cases, criminal suspects, confession confirmation.
Well, we would have to realize that, as I recall, the Zucco and Kleinman's lab study, the percentages correct were in the order of 60 to 65.
Yeah, that's correct.
Not reflected in your slide.
No, it's not, because they weren't real polygraph examiners. They were students. They weren't given all the data.
So you did have some criteria for
right.
your selection, and we can find out what.
Yes, sir. And that's referenced on the webpage. I didn't want to take time today to go through all of this.
Could you clarify as precisely as possible your use of the term independent evaluators?
An independent evaluator would be someone who's given the polygraph charts and nothing else.
Each of these studies used the results of one evaluator or multiple evaluators?
There's a mixture. Some studies have had more than one, some have just one independent evaluator.
So in the studies with many evaluators, more than one evaluator, reported a percentage accuracy, is that the accuracy of an individual evaluator or of a consensus among the evaluators?
The data that I just presented is a single evaluator. So I haven't addressed the issue of Reliance Level yet.
When you say nothing else, are you referring to the tracings only, the scripts?
No, the independent evaluators would be given the tracings only and some code for which question is which type. But that's all. Okay. From the field studies, the original examiners do much better. They have a much higher accuracy rate, which suggests that they're gaining information from something other than the chart. I just want to raise that as a point. Now, the original examiners, almost every field study of which I'm aware, have done better than the independent evaluators. And you know, that's a source of variability we have not mined very well in terms of reasoning.
Would the decisions you showed on the last page include cases in which direct admissions or information other than what's concluded on the chart led to a decision that the person was deceptive? So that one you have
no.
The original.
No, those would be decisions made before. There might be confessions that came after the polygraph examiner made a decision, but the decision was not part, the confession was not part of the decision the polygraph examiner made.
So that in those studies, if someone made a confession during the course of a polygraph examination, Would those not be included?
Yeah, those would not be included because the exam would not have been complete.
Okay.
Charles? There's obviously a ground truth difference between operationalization between the laboratory studies and field studies. So in this accuracy data that you just presented in the field, the original examiner, I assume, what was the basis for ground truth?
Confession. And that leads to problems as well, because that reduces the sample case.
Yes. I mean, confession one.
Confession sometime after the polygraph test. Or confession by somebody else. Some of the cases could be confirmed. There are multiple suspects. Another suspect confesses. That confirms the other polygraphs.
So the ones who don't confess are considered innocent, the ones who do confess are guilty?
No. Innocent would be people in multiple suspect cases where someone else has confessed.
Oh, someone else.
Right. Yeah, and those lead to sampling biases because that reduces the sampling pool down to somewhere around 10 or 15%. That's a problem with the field studies in that, you know, we have that sampling bias built in, we don't know what that means. Research, coming back to the question was posed, research has shown that the control question test is pretty robust to individual differences. There's very little in the literature on effects of personality. Almost no significant effects. And the ones that are there are very small in magnitude. Not a lot has been done on demographics, but there's some work on demographics in terms of socioeconomic status, gender. Things don't seem to matter.
Are those individual differences among the testees or the testers?
Testees. Nobody's looked at testers.
So none of these studies look at the interaction between testee and tester.
Not that I'm aware of. It's an interesting question, but I don't think anybody's done
it. Another citation, are these published peer-reviewed studies?
Some are, some aren't. Some of them have been papers given at conventions. I've done most of this work in terms of personality. There are three studies published on psychopathy, antisocial personalities, or socialization, however you want to operationalize it. Haven't found much.
What about the demographic study?
Demographic study hasn't been published. The only data I'm aware of came out of the Department of Defense, actually Dr. Reed did. I'm going to ask her about that later on. But I don't think much has been found. We've looked at gender differences in a number of studies. Nothing's come up there. It hasn't seemed to be a very productive area to look at.
Separating the data drawn from federal agencies, from various criminal and prosecutorial agencies throughout the states, is, would you say, a fair assessment of the demographic, the lack of demographic research is the fact that data are simply not kept by various demographic categories, or is it non-productive because many studies have attempted to find stuff and the effect sizes are nil?
On the personality side, I
lost it in the demographics.
Demographics, I think the data are kept, I just think nobody's looked very much. And what looking has been done has not been productive. I would think that most polygraph examiners, from their clinical experience, would not see this as a major issue. And I would concur with that. I just have not felt that there were major problems here. Until you get to really extremes, extremely low intelligence, then you're going to start, I think, to have some difficulties. Probably at the other end as well. People can think too much during a polygraph test, perhaps. And analyze it too much. So I think, you know, maybe at extremes of certain characteristics.
Well, again, I think you're referring more to the personality.
Yeah, that probably is. But I, you know, demographics, I don't see as a big issue.
Despite recent published evidence about racial, gender, socioeconomic status, and physical stigma influencing cardiovascular responses of both the stigmatized and the non-stigmatized.
You know, but I think that comes, I mean, I think it's likely that certain groups are going to be more aroused by the situation, but the kind of differential reactivity that's looked for between relevant and comparison questions are not going to be affected by
it. Unless, of course, it interacts with the benign control question versus a more difficult, even if it's only affectively difficult, critical question.
Possible, but I have to tell you, I don't. This is a purely clinical answer. From having run about 2,000 of these, I run a lot of different ethnic backgrounds, a lot of socioeconomic range. some pass and some don't. I mean, I don't see that. I don't feel that that's a problem. I could be wrong, and I don't think data have addressed it. So you got clinicians to answer it.
As far as personality, what kinds of personality? You said not that it doesn't seem productive, but there's been some research and it hasn't shown much. Can you tell me what personality differences have been investigated and haven't shown much?
Intelligence, socialization, the subscales of the icing, so introversion, extroversion, neuroticism, stability. Type A, type B, and there's been research on that. But those are the ones that come to mind as well.
What about, say, does the subscales of the personality test, does that include things like tendency to anxiety, for example?
Yeah, trait anxiety has been looked at, trait state anxiety for using Spielberger's measures. Nothing there. Just correlation's near zero.
Are there published studies about that?
You know, I think the only thing some of them are published. The socialization papers are published. There is some published work on the icing subscales. The anxiety stuff has not been. That was work that I did. I gave it at a meeting, never got it published. So one of those things that slipped through the sieve.
Populations. Data were from what source?
Most of those are from laboratory studies that involved recruitment in the general population through health warning ads. Some of it on college students, but most of it from general population health warning ads.
Any sense of size of these studies you know?
Group N's under 50, some 25-ish. Not large, but you're not going to find large studies in this area. The subjects are expensive in terms of time and effort.
We'll let you do one more transparency soon.
We've shown us field study results and lab study results. Is there any evidence you know of that suggests one of these is more accurate than the other?
I think they converge quite well. From my point of view, the results converge quite well and reinforce each other. The lab obviously is more useful for certain questions. I think there's certain questions that are very difficult to address in the field like countermeasures. Although I'm going to suggest if I get a chance, I'm going to suggest a study for you that would look at countermeasures in a field like setting. I think we need both because I think they address different weaknesses. We can't bring the motivational setting into the lab. We can't take the control into the field.
Go for it fast.
Okay. Drug countermeasures have not proven to be effective. And there are several studies in the literature on that that just don't seem to work very well. I'm just going to go on by it. The sites are available, again, on my web pages in that amicus from the Shepherd case. We don't know much about the effects of illness, either medical, mental, or physical. Just no research. So I don't have any answers for that at all. Again, clinically, I would suggest that this is not a huge concern. If someone has mental illness, I think sufficient enough to interfere with these tests, that's going to be obvious and you're not going to want to test them. But I don't have data to support that. Again, that's a clinician's answer. I don't think implementation by the government currently rises to the scientific potential. And I think there are problems with the scoring system that's in use by the government. It's a system that's been around a long time. I just finished a study with the Department of Defense where we took a set of charts and sent it to them. They had three of their instructors from the Polygraph Institute score them. And frankly, they had some reliability problems. Their numerical scores on respiration were not reliable. There's an inter-rater reliability of 0.29.
Is this a three-point scoring system? I just wanted to make sure it wasn't.
This was a seven-point. So, some problems. Respiration wasn't very reliable. Electrodermal response was. Blood pressure was moderate.
Same 0.60 that we found.
No, this is an inter-rater. This is not a validity coefficient. This is an inter-rater reliability. So we took the numerical scores were generated by three raters and intercorrelated them. This is the average. So the average inter-rater reliability on respiration was 0.29. The numbers I gave you before were validity coefficients. Okay, those were correlations with innocence and guilt.
Okay.
So these are not validity. These are inter-rater. And I think that's that suggests at least. Especially in respiration, serious problem. That they're not applying their scoring system consistently. The scoring system was developed at the University of Utah, produces much higher inter-rater reliabilities. We never saw anything like this in the studies that were done at Utah. The work I've done with the Canadian Police College, they get much higher inter-rater reliabilities than this. This is a matter, I think, for real concern.
Is this manuscript available?
It's actually just been submitted. It's at the Journal of Applied Psych right now, and it's under review. So hopefully it'll be available in 51.
You're assuming that lower reliability is worse.
It seems, well, I'm coming back to the government. The data you saw before, particularly the laboratory studies, came out of the University of Utah as a different story. So I'm drawing the contrast now between potential and reality.
But in terms of accuracy, you're assuming that the lower reliability will translate to lower accuracy of the testing?
I would assume so, yeah. And in fact, there are other people here who are going to address the research that's coming out of DogPound. And one of the problems is that they haven't published much lately. But when I left from there in 1990, they were not getting anywhere near the accuracy rates that I've shown you, which are what come out of the University of Utah and Mike Dawson's lab at UCLA and other places. DogPile was not performing at the level I showed you when I left there in 1990. Now, I don't know what they're doing now because they're not publishing what they're doing now.
Are you talking about the same test?
Yes, we're talking about a specific issue test that's to resolve a single issue. I haven't gotten the screening yet.
Okay.
Just about to get there. One thing I was very surprised at when we sent our data to the Polygraph Institute was that they don't use the vasomotor recording. In fact, they told me they had no idea what it was or how to score it. Those of you who have some background in psychophysiology know that vasomotor recordings have been around a long time and have been very useful in psychophysiology. They simply don't use them. In fact, they asked me to take them off the charts. I was afraid they were going to be confusing, which I thought was just absolutely amazing. They're not making use of the available technology. We've moved into a computerized world in Polygraph. There are programs available that will let you bring the images up on the screen, vary the time course, change the amplifier settings to essentially magnify the scoring and what you can see on it, and use the computer to make measurements rather than having to do it with a ruler on paper. And they didn't want to do that. They wanted to score paper charts. They actually had to take things off the computer and put them on paper in order for them to score. There's a report around. I don't know how many of you have seen it. I don't know if it's in the database for the committee. Stephen Porges, who's familiar to some of you, and a group of other psychophysiologists were asked by CIA a number of years ago to take a look at the work that was done by ABL at that time. and also at the instruments that are being used by the government. They wrote a report which has been pretty actively suppressed. I have copies of it if any of the members of the committee would like it.
We have it? We have copies of
okay.
it for all
good.
Members.
But there's their conclusion about the algorithms that the government's using. They're perplexed by an atheoretical descriptive approach, lack of understanding of physiology, psychophysiology, signal processing, physiological monitoring, hardware, and statistical theory. It's a pretty negative report. I would recommend that you read it. They don't like the instruments that's being used. The Axiton is the main instrument that's being used by the government. They think it represents 40-year-old hardware. I think being generous.
Can I ask a question? I'm still not looking at it specifically, because my understanding is that the scoring methods used by different agencies are not identical, and I don't know if the machines used by every agency are identical. And maybe that I'm wrong about that.
Well, again, I mean, there are people here who can address that. All the federal examiners are taught the same system. They all go to the Polygraph Institute, and they're all taught the same system.
So when you say the government, are you referring generally to DOD PI?
DOD PI now, yeah, because they train all the federal examiners.
Okay.
And they're as close as you're going to get to standardization in this field. Now, when they go out to the individual agencies, and again, I've been away from this for a few years, but there were differences that were imposed by the home agencies once they got to them. But they all start from the same place. And when I refer to government, I'm referring to where they start from. You know, the extent that they diverge, it's going to make the problems work.
Charles,
mm-hmm.
before you leave that, leave the topic of the technology, I have not been able to glean explanation for what looked to me to be apparently gain adjustments to recenter curves coming out on charts that are then scored. So can you comment on that? What am I missing? So, for example, the Axiton will indicate
right.
with a little arrow that this particular, you know, skin conductance or whatever has been adjusted upwards or downwards.
Right.
The only response I've ever gotten is, well, it's getting out of the range of
right.
what we can see in the paper.
That's not a gain change, that's an offset change. So there's an offset resistor at some point, and that's
yeah.
been altered to move the tracing to a different calibration mark.
And is that offset kept in mind in Don Pye's scoring techniques?
I have not. Well,
when the examiner then scores after having made that offset adjustment, is
that has no impact on the actual measurement of the phasic responses. It hasn't changed the gain. If you could take the paper and cut it and piece
no,
it
no,
off,
you'd
have a continuous record.
I understand that, but that also assumes that also seems to assume that those changes don't continue to vary very much over time. If it's a constant, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But there was a reason for it drifting to begin with.
Yeah, and part of the reason is the poor quality instrumentation.
Okay, so you believe it's a technological yeah. problem, not
I don't,
not a physiological problem.
I use the system from Stolping. I don't have that problem.
Okay.
It's a much more stable instrument.
Thank you.
And on laboratory quality, psychophysiology equipment, you don't have that problem either.
Okay.
When it comes to screening, the data, there aren't many data available. What we have, raise some questions. Again, I hope this is a report you have, but not, I'll get
yes.
you a copy. This was a large study that was done at the Department of Defense Polygraph Institute. Actually, the first that was done there. Gordon Barlin had run the study. The data had already been collected when I came on board. I was given the chance to analyze it. Examiners were brought in from four different agencies, CIA, NSA, Military Intelligence, Air Force OSI, and a very large, complex laboratory study was run. People were recruited from Fort McClellan personnel. They were involved in very complex scenarios where they took documents that were, for all intents and purposes, looked like secret documents. They were marked like secret documents. They met people in town. They passed money. They made dead drops. They were involved in all of the acts of espionage, except, of course, it was set up. It was probably the most complex and impressive laboratory study that has ever been done, or I think probably ever will be done. I have no idea what it cost the government to run it, but it was phenomenal. The number of people involved. And we got a real surprising outcome from it. I think we were all surprised by the outcome we got. The tests that were run did well with the innocent people. We got a false positive rate of about 6%. What surprised all of us was that they didn't do well at all with the guilty people. False negative rate is 60%. Everybody sort of scrambled around after that, trying to figure out what was going on. And when we then went to, these are the original examiners, by the way. We went to independent evaluation, the accuracy rates drop even more. And this, as you might imagine, stirred up quite an uproar within the government, and I'll come back to that in a bit.
Let me ask you.
Go ahead.
The base rate in this study, the base rate for ground truth was 50%.
Pretty close. It wasn't exact, but it's pretty close. Yeah. The examiners didn't know that, though.
Yeah. My question was, the failure rate on this test compared to some other settings I've seen is relatively low. What was the examiner's expectation about base rate?
They weren't given any. They were told to behave as they would at their home agencies in running these tests. So I think, you know, Sheila, I don't remember if we asked them what their expectation of base rate was. We did ask them that, and they expected about 25% to be true. That's my recollection. Don't hold me to that, but they expected a low base rate of truthfulness.
That was in advance.
No, this was post hoc. This would have been during debriefing, but it was before they knew the results of the study.
That 25% truth?
Yeah. That's my recollection. I could be wrong on that, but they expected
maybe the other way around, because it failed about 45% of the people.
No,
I'm sorry.
No, they passed almost everybody,
right.
Which would fit their expectation.
No, you said 25%
truthful.
You meant 25%.
I meant deceptive. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I said that wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, they expected a low rate of deception. I didn't say that wrong.
Okay.
They expected, and it fits, so that fits the data. We don't have any comparable studies since then that have been put out in the literature. I think Dr. Reed's going to talk about some work she did in developing the test. But we do have the DoD reports from COPS. And if you look at those, one of the things to me that's extremely striking from those is how few people they call deception. So in that open program that they report to Congress on every year, that in 2000 they reported 7,890 tests in that program, and only 202 deceptions. Even if all 202 of those are wrong, the false positive rate is minuscule. And they aren't, because many of them were followed up by confessions and admissions. Those numbers map pretty well on the data that Borland came up with. That you've got a test that works extremely well on innocent and it's not catching very many of the guilties, particularly, and I think for the committee, when you look at those DoD reports from Congress, look at what the confessions are to. They're not confessing to being spies. Not very many of them. They're not confessing to things that are even espionage. They're confessing to security violations. They've talked to people they shouldn't have. They've classified materials home. They wrote classified materials on a computer at home that wasn't approved for classified work. What's the base rate of security violations? a lot higher than the base rate for espionage. I don't know the answer to that. In the Barlin study, we got about a 20% confession rate to security violations from our laboratory subjects. So I think the base rate is, you know, I mean, I think it depends on what you're looking for when you want to think about what the base rate is. If you're looking for security violations, it's a heck of a lot higher than it is if you're looking for espionage and sabotage.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You said that you got about 25% admissions to security violations in the Barlin study, and then the post hoc expectation. Deceptive was also 25%.
Yeah, but that's the program deceptive that we're participating in the scenarios. 25% confessed a real security violation.
I understand that difference.
Yeah.
But one wonders when you talk about studies like this, how expectancies are set up for base rates, even though they're not, the subject. So that connection seems awfully interesting.
I agree.
So it certainly doesn't rule out the possibility that as they're going along in a study, examiners get kind of interested in base rates. And I know in recent studies that probably aren't published yet, but that they go to great lengths not to let those base rates out. But there are expectancies developed over time, and that just seemed like a natural connection, unless I'm missing something, that in fact 25% of the subjects were admitted to real security violations, that might be somehow causal.
Yeah,
to
that's possible.
Okay.
That's possible. Absolutely. Yes. Well, I have a question too. Countermeasures, this one will go a lot quicker. Are there countermeasures that are known or likely to be effective in masking deceptive answers during the polygraph session and then during repeated sessions? And short answer is yes. I've published most of the research on countermeasures, a couple studies in Journal of Applied, other places. And some relatively simple, and I need to change this just slightly, because they don't mask the deceptive responses. What we've been able to do are augment responses to comparison questions. It's a heck of a lot harder to mask physiological responding than it is to create it. It's a relatively easy thing to create responses. And so we've had people do things like tense the large muscles in their legs by pressing their toes against the floor, bite their tongue, even do mental arithmetic. And if you roll all the studies together, we can, in the laboratory, generate about a 50% false negative rate. Now, there are things that somewhat ameliorate that. The algorithm that was developed at the University of Utah cuts down about half. It does better than the numeric scores and drops it down in the 20-25% range.